I question, if we extend ourselves beyond the selves we have come to be, would we rather then to see ourselves as the selves we are potentially, or would we wish to see the selves we'd like other selves to see, the selves their selves instruct ourselves to be? To be or not to be, that is the question.
Oh, interesting. Thank you, Mr. Harger. Well, that may be our introduction to Write Stuff today, because I have a poet in the studio, Bill Harger, and it was going to be a sound check, but nice poem. So thanks for coming in, Bill, and thanks for reading your poetry. And let me tell you a little bit about Write Stuff. If you're new to this show, this is Jim Dowling, the host, and I bring in a different writer every month on the fourth Thursday of each month, 8 o'clock, 8 p.m. I interview that writer. They share their work. We get to know a writer. Pretty interesting. So I hope you enjoy yourself. I have a very special guest today, a man who's led a very interesting life. And if I can get him to open up a little bit, we're in for a good time. So again, Bill, thank you for coming in. And I'm going to read just a little bit of a blurb in the back of one of your books, just so people get an idea of who you are and where you've been in life. Now, hold on here. I should have had a bookmark here. Okay, here we go. William Harger spent his early years as an aeronautical engineer. After his tenure as an inventor in an IBM think tank, he moved into the wilderness of Northern California, where he pursued his first love, poetry. He co-founded the National Environmental Education Development at Whiskeytown Lake in Shasta County, California, which continues to enlighten fifth and sixth graders after more than 40 years. Now, that little blurb contains a little kernel of why I know Will. I also worked at what we now call West Camp up there. It used to be called Need Camp, the environmental school west of town up near Whiskeytown Lake. And Will Harger, Bill here, was one of the founders of that school. So, Bill, can we kick this off by talking a little bit about how that school came about?
Well, the park, which was at that time directed by Leon Mitchell, and the school here in Shasta County, headed up by Ray Darby and a fellow named Dean Dennett, got together with an office down in San Francisco, which was a federal forestry concern, and they were looking around for a couple of guys to help them put together curriculum. And they had heard about me teaching at the high school and the grammar school in Trinity County, and had heard that the kids really enjoyed the things I had to say. And they learned also that as a young man, I spent much time in the woods. Well, at that time, ecology wasn't a very well-known word. As a matter of fact, it was kind of like referred to as a communist plot by some people.
Okay.
And so we knew we were going to have a hard go putting this school together. But we went ahead and started enrolling about 100 kids. They would come and live with us for a week with about 16 counselors, and we had 16 cabins, and we broke all the kids and the counselors up into various cabins and started off on our curriculum, which we made up. Lee Morford was my partner at that time. He was a Forest Service retiree and a very knowledgeable man. And of course, I had this rapport with the children. So we just took off, and the school became very popular, although we had some difficulties with the John Birch Society and some other rather conservative people who were a little afraid of the broadness of ecology. You may not know this, but ecology as a term led to a thing called environmental ethics later on, and the whole concept of ecology and environmental ethics go hand in hand, and they really began to become popular in the late 60s and early 70s.
Yeah, and so you guys created a pretty vibrant curriculum. I mean, when I worked up there a few years ago before the fire, we were still using a lot of the things that, you know, it wasn't that different from what you were teaching. We were still taking the kids out in the creek and catching things and identifying them and trying to, understand how all these animals coexist and things like food chains and you know, the relationship between insects and
the sand. Interrelationships were a very important part of what Lee and I tried to do to show that nature was interconnected. There weren't a bunch of separate things to study independently. The whole idea was to look at nature as a giant family that was kind of under the umbrella of this great power called life, which only existed on the earth as far as we knew. So life was a gift of power that the earth somehow or other embraced. Nobody knows to this day really how that happened.
Sure.
It's a spiritual power.
Hey, excellent. Well, I'm going to branch off for just a second because I want you to know that Bill was he retired from IBM, where he had a unique job, and he went on to help design some aerospace, like a wind tunnel design, I think. Then he taught at College of the Redwoods. He's written books of poetry. And I think today, just because we cover so much ground with you, Bill, we're going to probably focus mostly on nature. You have a philosophical book called Toad Talk, and I want to get to that right now. Okay, Bill, I'm looking at the preface to your book, Toad Talk, and here's the opening line. The word is in the title of this work is the operative word. Is refers to reality in a very real sense. Can you expound on that?
Sure. Toad Talk has a subtitle, What Life and Stuff Is, and is refers to reality. We misuse the word and come up with a lot of isms. These isms are constructs of different ideologies, different cultures, different egos, different desires to present things in their own point of view, but the is's that they come up with are not really based on reality. They're really based on a person's history and culture and education. The idea of using toad is that a toad, I would believe, would know nature and reality as it truly is, and would philosophize from that foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And so the toad in Toad Talk is an old guy who has lots of experience, maybe even me,
yeah.
But he begs for clear thinking.
Right.
He begs for an understanding of what really is. So when he answers his questions on the various themes through the book, he comes up with answers that are not probably really very familiar to us. Like, for instance, when he talks about death, he says, I think death does not exist. That kind of opens your mind, and you have to go on and find out just what is he working on now.
Okay. Well, let's find a short selection while we're talking about Toad Talks. Let's see if we can find something short to read here. Okay, while we're looking at Toad Talk, and this is a wonderful book. It's really easy to read. It's very poetic. But every once in a while, this toad, who turns out to be quite wise, breaks out into poetry. And I'm asking Bill if he'll read one called Life.
The idea of the book is to speak in English to the people, the animals, and an old professor who is asking him questions. But the interesting thing about Toad is that he'll answer the questions, but he thinks in poetry. So he may be talking to his audience, but before he does, he refers to his own mind, and there's a poem in there that helps guide him. So they wanted to know about life, and he's explaining to them that life just flows and flows, and his answer to the population was really kind of circular, he thought. So he does it in this way. Life doesn't follow our instructions very well. She has her very own feelings about what fun is and how things should go, and she really doesn't care to share her plan with anyone. Life just flows and flows, and we can either hitch a ride or stand off to the side and lose her. She won't care. She's the most self-centered lover a being can have, but the most generous as well. She's the best, the only one we really want, and we can have all we can take just so long as we don't ask for anything.
Beautiful poem. Beautiful. Thank you, Bill.
A little thing about life that I like personally is perhaps a little obtuse, but it's one of my favorites. Life screams from the open blue, seems to center around you when you least expect it. I don't know why it sounds so fine and pulses this heart of mine, except it must be some divine gift we cannot find unless we are not seeking.
Unless we are not seeking. Good. Beautiful. Thank you. Bill, you live up in the mountains out of Douglas City. How did you end up there?
Well, my engineering career was magical, really. I had 4 very high-powered jobs and rose to the top of each one of them very quickly as a young man until the time I was about like 34 or 35. I started my engineering career when I was 19 with a degree in aeronautical engineering. I ended up being an inventor for IBM, got caught up in the development of the credit card and the magnetic strip that you carry in your pocket right now.
So you're the reason we're all broke.
But no, it was
a joke.
It was also political.
Sure.
And I was very upset about the fact that I had a project taken away from me to solve a problem from Poughkeepsie and Rochester IBM that had to do with credit cards. And the project had to do with teaching. See, in those days, we didn't have PCs. We were just inventing the personal computer at that time. But me and another fellow were putting together a program where kids could type in information and communicate with the rest of the world by looking at pictures and things that would show up on the screen that they had in front of them. It got taken away from me quite illegally, and it ended up with me being quite bitter, and so I moved to a think tank for IBM, and I was there for a while as an inventor. Again, my whole job was not assigned. I was just supposed to roam the halls and drop in and meet people and see if I could help them simplify their problems. So I just said, I'm leaving. I got to get out of here. There was a blue-belly lizard doing push-ups outside my office window, and I looked at him, and he reminded me of Trinity County and when I was a boy, and I just thought, I just want to be like that lizard. And so I quit that day and sold the house. It was a very large, very beautiful brick structure in Los Gatos, California, and came up here and continued writing poetry that I had started perhaps 6 months or a year ago, and started, shall we say, substituting at the grammar school and the high school here. And that's where the people from the Shasta County School District got acquainted with me.
Okay. And so what was the title of that job they finally gave you? I mean, what was the... When IBM changed your job, you were basically a problem solver, weren't you?
Yes, IBM. I was. That's probably pretty much what I was my entire career. I had this weird mechanical ability to see things in 3 dimensions, and I was really interested in the concept that I had in my own mind that other people disagreed with, which was genius is simplicity, not complexity. And oftentimes my bosses would get irritated with me because I'd want to simplify the mechanism rather than make it more complicated, which in their mind was a sign of creativity and genius. But I disagreed. And so I was able to move through my careers with that idea in mind, and it worked out very well finally. As I got older, I became more assertive.
Okay, and then you eventually ended up over on the coast and teaching at College of the Redwoods, right?
Well, yeah, I was advised by a couple of psychologists to get into child psychology because I liked working with children, and I had had some experience through their guidance of working with children who had terminal cancer.
Wow.
And so I went to HSU to interview the psychology department, and I just absolutely did not like it at all. It was all old stuff. It was all, to me, not very innovative, not very exciting, not very broad. And so I just said, I don't want to do this. And when I was walking out, the secretary who had been listening in said, you should be a sociologist. So I went to the sociology department, and I ended up getting a master's in the social sciences, which, by the way, was the basis for my master's thesis, which was Toad Talk, which is a story in and of its own.
Yeah, fascinating story. Fascinating story. So, well, great. We're going to be shortchanged if we don't share more of your poetry today. But, okay, before we jump into some of these beautiful poems, how did you end up on the end of a dirt road above outside of Weaverville?
Well, I was raised on a dirt road outside of Lewiston, California, and as a young man spent nearly all of my time with a shaggy dog. I lived in my grandmother's cabin. My parents and grandmother were poor, and they would drift down to Los Angeles every once in a while, where my stepfather would go to work, make a little money, and they'd leave me alone. And so I would have to split my wood and keep the homestead going, and I became very self-sufficient and really loved the outdoors. So when I moved back to Trinity County, I moved as far away from civilization as I could, way up a creek called Indian Creek outside of Douglas City, and found that I was beyond the grid. So I immediately started using my inventive talents, coupling old pieces of equipment and stuff like that to put together a Pelton wheel that gave me electricity and a water clock, which turned my meadows on every once in a while if I wasn't around, and ended up building a rather nice home up a canyon that had never been inhabited ever by anybody except Indians. The canyon was flood prone. So I bought an old cat and reshaped the land, redirected the water, and I've been up there now for nearly 50 years.
Okay, you mentioned two things that a lot of us probably don't know much about. One is a water clock, and the Pelton, what was that? Pelton something?
Oh, the Pelton wheel.
The Pelton. What are these things? I know they help you live on your property, and I know they're off-the-grid technology. Just give us a little idea what you're dealing with.
Well, the Pelton wheel that I built was built of a scrap seed spreader that sat down at the bottom of a John Deere seed spreader. It had little cups in it. And when water hit that little cups, it would spin that wheel very fast. So I got an old Chevy generator, a Delco Remy, and charged batteries with that, and then purchased a thing called an inverter, which inverts 12 volts to 120, which a lot of people have hooked up in their pickup trucks. I would open up a big valve. I had a storage pond up the canyon, and I would open up a big valve, and that thing would spin, and it would generate. and it would charge the batteries, and I'd convert that to 120, and I still have that today. After all this time, it has worked. They're very expensive, but mine cost nothing. I just used junk that I found. Being an inventor, I had that ability to marry things. The water clock is a simple thing that I witnessed. There was an old mine called the Dixie Queen, I believe, up Spring Gulch, and I was hiking up there one day collecting junk and walked up his little canyon and saw that he had a barrel, and when the barrel filled up, it emptied itself, and when it emptied itself, it flushed gold and wow. stuff down a sluice box. I thought, hey, I'll bet you I could come up with something like that to turn on my meadow water when I'm gone. So I put a thing called the meadow monitor, or it's actually a water clock, and it just simply is a bucket that fills up with water, and when it gets to a certain weight, it overcomes a large lever, which also has a return weight, and opens up a big valve in the ground. The barrel has a hole in the bottom of it, and after an hour and a half, it's empty, and so the weights swing the big lever the other way, shuts off the water going to the meadow, and my water tank up on the mountain fills back up, and when it's filled, the overflow water comes down and fills up the barrel again. Everybody likes it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm sitting here interviewing you, pretending I've never been up there. I was a guest once at your place, and I saw all this stuff. It's amazing, you know. Bill has built this house at the end of a road. How long did it take to build that thing? It's a beautiful house.
Say that again.
How long did it take you to put that place together?
Well, originally I had a little crummy little trailer, 1948, almost a cardboard little house trailer, and I added a room to that, just one single room with a loft, which I used as a bedroom. But I met this woman, and she wasn't at all comfortable with that. She had three boys, and it was a very tiny place. So I dug a hole behind the trailer, pulled the trailer out, built a nice big kitchen, and a couple years later added to the front of the house, and it's all kind of sunk in the ground. So it's stone walls with dirt behind for about 3 feet. And that's kind of a takeoff on the way my grandfather, who was a gold miner and a Russian, built two of the homes he had. He like built them into holes in the ground, and I guess that was just kind of like stuck in my head. So it's kind of neat, really. It keeps things cool, it keeps things warm, and now it's a nice, very nice two-bedroom home with a sunken living room, and everybody who goes there marvels that I built it by myself. Since I use scrap lumber from old buildings and peeled my own poles and things, it really didn't cost me very much.
No, it is a thing of beauty. Very comfortable up there. Okay, Bill, with the time we have left, I just want you to have fun. Pick any poems you want to read, and we will listen. Thank you.
Well, these poems have their settings in the wilderness, but they range through philosophy, love poems, family poems. Here's one I like. Actually, this really happened. It's called, well, I won't tell you the title until the end. Not one of the three rattlesnakes I stepped on last summer did me in, and the chainsaw that chased my throat last fall didn't end it all for me, and falling off that ridge didn't even lend a little bruise. Yes, a great many things tried to abuse and do their little thing on me this last year or so, but I was so fast and nimble, or just so lucky, that nothing even came close to killing me, except love. Love almost did.
By the way, that's a personal favorite, but keep going, keep going. Anything you want to read is fine.
This is a little family poem. It actually happened as well. It's a true story. It was in those days, they used to cut down big pine trees for firewood using a big cross-cut two-man saw, and I would go up there every once in a while with my bicycle and watch my uncle and my dad. Here we go. Me and my uncle and my dad were buddies when I was little, and I used to go out in the woods with them. But once, they left the job without me, and I had to ride my bike all the way home alone. Was I ever mad? I really got myself worked up. You know how it is. Even got hysterical. And so I had to invent this story about being chased all the way home by a big, mean, and very fast bear to explain my crying, to make them feel bad, and because I just couldn't stop myself. Well, my mom was skeptical. She knew I was lying. And so she told my uncle and my dad to go out and see if they could find some bear prints. And if they didn't, I was going to get it. So they went out the door and I cried some more. And then they came back and told her about the biggest set of bear prints, vicious and fast bear prints, they ever did see. Remember in the beginning, I told you, me and my uncle and my dad were buddies when I was little.
Beautiful. All right. I think we have time for one more. Let's see if you can find something there.
Well, let's see here. How about something? Yeah, how about something maybe a little more philosophical, but still nature-oriented?
Sounds good.
Many things seem cruel to us as we view the natural scene, and many times we try to change things for the better if we can. But it seems we can never come to understand that all is good on this world spinning round, and it is man and man alone that causes a disarray in the schemes conceived in nature's dreams and in nature's amazing way.
Oh, beautiful way to tie this up. Thank you so much for reading, Bill. And, you know, we're going to have to do this again. We are.
Well, I would like to do it again.
Yeah, I think we got a lot to cover here. You've got a lot of really fine poetry, and I think my listeners need to hear them. So,
well, it'll be my pleasure to come back.
Okay. Well,
and we should go kayaking again, too.
Yes, yes. We've had some good times on the lake. So, all right, folks, that's going to be a wrap, I guess. This is Jim Dowling on Right Stuff with my guest today, Bill Harger. And I hope you enjoyed it. This is KKRN 88.5 FM Community Radio out of Round Mountain. And so, you know, this is community radio. If you want to help keep us on the air, you can go to kkrn.org and hit the donate button. Or let's just say you have an old vehicle sitting around you want to get rid of. Go to careasy.org. They'll walk you through it, and you can get a little bit of money to this radio station. All right. Hope you had a good evening, and thank you for listening.